Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, Flashpoint Ukraine. We discuss the ongoing situation in the Ukraine by looking at a new book by Clarity Press, edited by Stephen Lenman. Flashpoint Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. We'll be joined by a few of the book's contributors for the hour. The noted political scientist and author, Dr. Michael Parenti, will be with us for the entire program. We will also be joined by Professor Michelle Chozadovsky of Global Research, the Center for Research on Globalization. Later in the program, we'll be joined by former Congresswoman and Green Party presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney. Peter Phillips and I, along with Nolan Higdon, are also contributors to this volume, Flashpoint Ukraine, and we hope you stay tuned with us for the hour today as we discuss this crucial issue developing as it is ongoing in its developments in the Ukraine. This book, Flashpoint in Ukraine, is out this week by Clarity Press. It's edited by Stephen Lenman. It is dedicated to all Ukrainians. May they achieve peace, equity, and justice. May they inspire others globally. May freedom triumph worldwide. So this is an incredible collection of very recent writings going back even only a few months. And it includes, again, many people, including our guests today, Michael Parenti, Michelle Sosadovsky, Cynthia McKinney. We'll be talking a little bit more about the contents of the book. But here is Peter to introduce Michael Parenti, who will be with us for the hour. Peter?
Michael's a longtime friend of Project Censored. He's a PhD from Yale, internationally known award-winning author, scholar, and lecturer who addresses a wide variety of political and cultural problems. His newest book, Face of Imperialism, is out in God and Demons, Contrary Notions, Michael Parenti Reader, a whole number of things. Welcome, Michael.
Hello, guys. How are you?
Great to have you with us today. Also on the line with us now is Michelle Chozadovsky. He's a professor emeritus of economics at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, and his most recent book is Towards a World War III Scenario, The Dangers of Nuclear War, which I used in my class last semester. Michelle, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Delighted to be on the program.
It's really great to have you. This new book out, Flashpoints in Ukraine, less than 3 weeks ago, we were still writing parts of it. So
absolutely.
It is out quite quickly. So you want to give us kind of a summary? You focused on Crimea. What would you like to say about what's happening
in
Ukraine today?
Well, the chapter was on Crimea, but I've focused on various aspects. But I think the issue of Crimea was somehow neglected by geopolitical analysts because they don't understand geography, in that Crimea is really the gateway to the Caspian Sea. It means that Russia controls waterways from the Black Sea up through the Don Valley, then across the Volga-Don Canal, and then down to the Caspian Sea, so that it is a very strategic waterway. And the Crimea is really between two portions of Russian territory, Crimea on one side and then the mainland, and the distance between Crimea and the mainland is something like 3 kilometers, 2 miles. They're building a bridge, and it's a very strategic location, because the riverways communicating, let's say, from the technically from the Mediterranean through the Black Sea and then up the Don and then taking the Volga down to the Caspian Sea. So that, from the Russians' point of view, was very important.
Well, that gives them a massive waterway exchange there, almost all the way to Moscow.
Absolutely. Absolutely, because the Don, the Volga, goes up to Moscow through another canal, and then it's the Moscow River. So that all those internal waterways are very important. And now that means that Ukraine, in losing Crimea, has absolutely no control, even with regard to the entrance to the Sea of Azov. Okay, the Sea of Azov is an internal waterway. It's contiguous to the Black Sea, but at the same time, you have to go through these very narrow straits, which are controlled by Russia now on both sides. And consequently, that area, which is historical, I mean, it's a very important area. It's the Sea of Azov. It's Rostov on the Don, and so on. I'm familiar with that area because my father was born in Rostov-on-the-Don. But from a geopolitical point of view, this is absolutely crucial. The movement in Crimea, they feel an attachment to Russia historically, going back in history. Eastern Ukraine, I think it's much more of a movement against the fascist government in Kiev. It's not solely integrated by pro-Russians. In fact, some of the leaders are Ukrainians. In fact, this whole notion of Russians versus Ukrainians is meaningless because essentially the language is almost identical, okay? And people intermarry and so on and so forth. So that they're really in Lugansk and Donetsk. It is a movement directed against the Kiev government. And now that Kiev government is not simply a coalition whereby neo-Nazi groups participate in the coalition. It is a neo-Nazi government. And I say that because the neo-Nazi emblems are now used in official entities of the National Guard, which depends on the Ministry of the Interior. Okay? So, I mean, if you want to look at the, let's say that the U.S. National Guard were to display a swastika, one would assume that they have the support of Homeland Security, okay? But, I mean, people would be up in arms. But there you have the National Guard, which is involved in these repressive actions on behalf of the government. They're not civilian militia. On behalf of the government, and they have neo-Nazi insignia, which are part of the uniform of the National Guard. This is not a loose coalition where you have two neo-Nazi parties. It is, in fact, a government, a coalition, which endorses neo-Nazi symbols, which are displayed in the reserves of the Ukrainian armed forces. And that reality is simply not even mentioned. Nobody in the United States knows that the United States is not only supporting that government, it is financing the National Guard of Ukraine, which is integrated, which has neo-Nazi symbols, integrated by right sector Svoboda, and it's there too with a mandate to protect American-style democracy in Ukraine. And then you have another, I mean, you can start looking, for instance, there's the so-called Azov Battalion, which is part of the National Guard. And the Azov Battalion, which is also dependent on the Ministry of the Interior, they display the emblem of the SS Division of the Third Reich. And they're very openly neo-Nazi as well.
And some of these people were trained in Poland even well before all of this happened, is our understanding in this new book. That's what it says. But talk a little bit about the recent election there and the new billionaire president that's now in Ukraine.
Well, that election, of course, we could discuss, does it have the legitimacy? Does it represent the will of the people? Certainly not in eastern Ukraine, but I think ultimately there wasn't much choice. It was either Yulia Tymoshenko or the, you know, or the oligarch, chocolate king, etc. And ultimately, he was the most popular candidate. The thing is that ultimately, these economic interests, they're acting pretty much in the same way as big corporations in the United States or in Western Europe. They're there to make money. They also have partnerships with different Western companies. And they are also feeding on exceedingly low wages in Ukraine. I mean, people get $100 a month, and those are factory workers. And consequently, the low costs of labor are, of course, an input in this process of enrichment. These are former members of the Soviet nomenklatura, usually very corrupt, and then involved in the acquisition of state property and through various means, and thereby building an empire. But it's really stealing from the state, because that's what happened at the end of the Cold War. But another dimension is the fact that right from the beginning, we're talking about 1992, as far as Russia and Ukraine are concerned, the IMF implemented what might be described as strong economic medicine. It was a very devastating type of economic remedy, which ultimately led to the impoverishment of the population. I mean, at the time I followed these first IMF reforms, they started in 1994, and then what happened? Price of fuel went up 900% overnight. And then what happened is that they, at the same time, they liberalized trade. So that, in effect, what they were doing, particularly with regard to the agricultural sector, is that they were creating conditions whereby the breadbasket was going bankrupt, and meanwhile, you were coming in with grain surpluses, which were sold on the internal market. But, of course, those who sold the U.S. grain on the internal market were not subjected to these massive increases in electricity prices, public transportation, and so on, which ultimately led to the destruction and displacement of the industrial as well as agricultural base of Ukraine. And that happened in 1994. It was an agreement signed in Madrid. They negotiated, and then they applied an IMF World Bank shock treatment, whereby from one day to the next, energy prices go fly high. And then they demand that U.S. grain surpluses and food aid be dumped on the domestic market, which then contributed to destabilizing one of the world's largest and most productive wheat economies.
We're speaking with Michel Chozadovsky. He is a contributor to a new book, Flashpoint Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. Michel Chozadovsky's contribution to the book is Crisis in Ukraine, Russia Extends Its Control Over the Black Sea and Strategic Waterways. Michel, you're going to stay with us here for a little while. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We'd like to bring in our other guest, Dr. Michael Parenti, who is with us for the hour today. Michael Parenti also contributed a chapter to this new book called Ukraine and Regime Change. Michael Parenti, welcome back to the Project Censored Show, and let's bring you into the conversation here.
Okay. I think what we have to do is not puzzle over Obama and say he's vacillating or he's acting too belligerent or acting not belligerent enough, and try to understand that, in fact, U.S. policy is brilliant, it's very successful, it's multi-dimensional, and it overthrows democratically elected presidents, or it puts in presidents, as it just did, who were, quote, democratically elected, like Poroshenko, supposedly, after overthrowing a government. So at any one time, the government is doing any kind of thing, is denouncing Al-Qaeda as a mortal threat and a mortal evil in the world, which caused us to go into Afghanistan and into Iraq. Supposedly, we had to fight Al-Qaeda. We were in a global war against this relentless terrorist group. And yet, in Libya and in Syria, the U.S. supported Al-Qaeda units and is still supporting Al-Qaeda units in these countries. So while this is all going on in Egypt, in Venezuela, in Thailand, Libya, Syria, you have this kind of regime change going on. Different measures are used according to what's there. In Thailand, you control the military, so you didn't need these death squads hitting soft targets. You didn't need the kind of attrition, the war of attrition that you're getting in Ukraine and that you're getting in Venezuela right now, where they're just going out and killing soft targets of people all over the place. So Obama is right in there like any other Democrat or Republican, carrying out the needs of the global empire. And I see Ukraine in that context, you see.
Michael Parenti, you write in your chapter, Ukraine and Regime Change, you start by talking about Crimea. Michel Chozadovsky was talking about that. But you also talk about NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and their role. And, of course, as Victoria Nuland, you write, proudly exclaimed, the U.S. poured some $5 billion into the struggle for regime change. What do you make about that kind of a pattern, destabilization and so forth?
Well, how else do you keep 10,000 people out in a square, feeding them portable potties, everything else, food, bedding, clothing, and killing off people scores of them being killed. You do it with a lot of money. They suddenly produce, they all produce the same T-shirts. You know, there's suddenly 2,000 people out there with this yellow T-shirt with the same printing on it. And all that. Signs that are held up in different languages, including English, so that when the global media come and look at this, we will be able to understand that these Ukrainians are fighting supposedly for freedom by overthrowing this democratic government. So this is the kind of thing that happens. You also mobilize Blackwater people, you Delta Force, operational forces of different kind, death squads. A lot of death squads, you know, in Iraq when we first moved in there, too. There were people that had to be cleaned out and wiped out, and that was never reported on. So there are these things that are done again and again in country after country. You destroy the country. You make it insufferable. You make it to the point where the people will surrender whatever it is they were supporting before, and you take it over. And why do you do that? You do that because of a larger pattern of empire. The empire is very consistent. Any leader, any movement, any political party, any government that uses the land, the labor, the natural resources, and the capital of that country for the betterment of its own people, for at least even a portion of it for betterment. And that's what they hate about Putin. He's been doing some of that. Any country that does that is targeted as an enemy of the U.S. You then begin to demonize the leadership. You talk about how totalitarian they are, or vicious they are, or crazy they are, and how the U.S. has to be called upon to help the poor people in that country, and to help them, really help them with an IMF, as Michelle was talking about, with an IMF loan of billions of dollars. Those billions of dollars, the people won't see a penny of it. They will own only the debt on that money, and they're in for it. The Ukrainian people are really in for it now. They're going to really get it shoved up the kazoo.
Michelle, let's go back to you. One of the things you wrote about in March was how, after the engineered coup, the gold in Ukraine was removed to New York. How is all of this engineered? Who are the players that helped create this coup from the U.S. side?
With regard to the gold, I should mention that this was based on reports which were unconfirmed. I mean, there were witness reports to the fact that the central bank, their gold had been confiscated and sent off to New York. I don't have any means of proving it one way or the other, but the report by Iskra News, it's a Russian news agency, is pretty convincing. And we have to understand that that is almost a standard procedure right now to confiscate countries' gold reserves. Well, we just witnessed this week that Ecuador is going to sell off its gold reserves to Goldman Sachs. And the Bloomberg analysis says it's because they need liquidity. No, they don't need liquidity. They need to sell their reserves so that they can pay an outstanding debt. And they're forced into doing it. And so that country is paying off the money it's owned by depleting its both its foreign exchange reserves as well as its gold. And I suspect the situation in Ukraine is similar. The country is bankrupt. These levels of debt are simply enormous. And the amounts that the IMF grants is, in any event, a fictitious concept because, as Michael mentioned, the money doesn't come into the country. It is already tagged for reimbursement of foreign creditors. So it really is. It's based on the old-fashioned notion of usury, where you can't pay back your debt, and then the creditor or the money lender said, "No problem, my son. I will lend you the money. And with the money that I lend you, you pay me back." And that's exactly what has happened in Ukraine. That money is already gone. And then what is devastating is that they don't get any money out of it, but then they have to accept a whole series of conditions. And those conditions mean essentially privatization, taking over assets, et cetera, et cetera. And the IMF now has said the second tranche of that loan won't be paid because of the situation in eastern Ukraine. These are devastating policies, and I think what we are witnessing here is what I would describe as regime rotation. It's regime change, but there's a whole sequencing. One party comes in, and then, of course, they're discredited because they're applying IMF reforms. They get thrown out, a new one comes in, and there's continuity. And that's what happened in Egypt. Okay, the IMF program started under Mubarak in 1991. Devastating reforms, destruction of the Nile Valley breadbasket, and so on. But what I think is worth pointing to is the fact that U.S. foreign policy has a terrorist option whereby they will finance and support covertly terrorist organizations, whether these are al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations or Boko Haram in Nigeria, which is also affiliated to al-Qaeda, or neo-Nazi groups in Ukraine. The purpose is to destabilize sovereign countries, and they are now involved in those actions in all major regions of the world, and particularly in regions where there are strategic resources, such as Central Africa, West Africa, Nigeria, a large populated country with large oil reserves, and so on. And so we are now witnessing, in effect, the simultaneous application of a regime change agenda, a regime change destabilization agenda, whereby terrorist organizations are quite overtly supported. It's not, I mean, we know that al-Nusra in Syria is supported by the United States, okay? We know it. We have formal proof of that. Yet, if you look at recent statements, they will say, we are combating terrorism in Syria. Well, it just so happens the government of Bashar al-Assad is also combating terrorism. And the fact of the matter is that the terrorists are supported covertly by U.S. intelligence, with the input from Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar. They're trained. NATO is involved. Israel is involved. So, and we have ample documentation to that effect.
We're speaking with Professor Michel Chozadovsky, a contributor to the recent book Flashpoint Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. We're also joined by Michael Parenti, another contributor to the book here. Michael, let's talk a little bit more about maybe some of the things Michel was saying, or also it was certainly something that we want to talk about in the next part of the program on media coverage of this. And certainly maybe a way to wrap up this half of the show is to talk about the double standards in Syria, the Syrian election, and what's going on in Syria is, of course, completely, according to the U.S. media, illegitimate and so forth. But what happens in the Ukraine is somehow perfectly acceptable and immediately recognized.
Right. Well, Syria, and we have even some so-called progressive commentators in the U.S. Using the standard terms. Syria, all these last few years, didn't have a government. It had a regime. It was a regime. And that's what we got. Whereas Saudi Arabia has a government. I mean, that's really weird, Saudi Arabia. In Ukraine, you find that the Kiev fascists were called protesters all the time. This is what they were called, or demonstrators. Whereas the eastern Ukrainians were called militants or rebels or pro-Russian resistors or these kind of terms. They were not called demonstrators or protesters, usually. So just in the use of the terms, you find, and in the use of and the treatment of the leaders, I said, I wish people would give some attention to the demonization of Putin. What has he done? He recommended to the eastern Ukrainians to not have that plebiscite that they had. He said, don't do it, you know. For a guy who supposedly is pushing for secessionism in eastern Ukraine, he hasn't really done very much at all. I don't think he wants to take on a multi-billion-dollar burden of eastern Ukraine, Odessa, Luhansk, Donetsk, What exactly has he done to be called and to be called a demon that he has been called, and being attacked in such a personalized way by all the different, all these different people on the air, and in the Brussels meeting just of this past week, it's very interesting that the French and the Germans and others greeted him and met with him individually, and did not seem to share Obama's bristling stuff. And the most disgusting character of all is probably John Kerry. There's nothing more disgusting than a weak man acting like a tough man, you know. And he just gets up there and he says, well, just let him this and this and we'll just show him, and just swaggers and talks tough, you know. And all he's doing is the same old liberal sucking up to the conservatives and getting pat on the head for it.
Indeed, Michael Parenti. There is a chapter in this book edited by Stephen Lendman, by Edward Herman and David Peterson, that looks at the propaganda system in overdrive here, and it addresses that very point. They do an analysis where they say that Putin is referred to as a Russian strongman by Thomas Friedman, a bare-chested muscle man by Roger Cohen, a villain by Nicholas Kristof, an unreconstructed Russian imperialist by John McCain. This list goes on and on.
And a Hitler by Hillary
Clinton. Hillary Clinton called him a Hitler.
Yeah.
It's not just a debasement of the language. It's a clear attack. It's a clear propagandistic screed against what's happening in favor of U.S. NATO empire building. Well, we're going to take a break.
I wanted to add something. That's done again and again. Noriega was an admirer of Hitler in Panama just before we invaded. You demonize the leader, the Noriega or Ortega, Saddam Hussein, who you cuddled when he was murdering and torturing people. You cuddled him. He was Washington's poster boy. When he started becoming assertive and wanted to keep a public economy and wanted a bigger chunk of the oil quota and getting out of line and doing things for his own country, then suddenly he became another Hitler. So you demonize the leaders, Milosevic in Yugoslavia. Oh, terrible, terrible. All he did was try to avoid war. But once you demonize them, you then have license to bomb their people or attack their people or bring death squads in on their people and that sort of thing. And it's just the same old stuff going on again.
We're joined by Michael Parenti and also Michelle Chozorowski. Michelle, can you stay with us for a bit after this break?
Absolutely.
Okay, we're going to go right now to a Project Censored Validated Independent News story that actually talks about Ukraine, and we're Andy Lee Roth and I are finishing the next Project Censored book, Censored 2015, Inspiring We the People, and we have some stories in here about the Ukraine, and here is a Validated Independent News story about the Ukraine from Project Censored. We'll also hear a quick musical break, and we will rejoin with Michael Parenti and Michelle Chozorowski after that break, and later in the program we'll be joined by Cynthia McKinney. Please stay with us.
For Project Censored, I'm Alexandria McDowell with today's Validated Independent News Story. As tensions between superpowers grow due to the crisis in Ukraine, U.S. media outlets fan the flames of conflict with a full front of propaganda in order to vilify Russia and its leader, Vladimir Putin. Stephen Cohen with The Nation provides coverage of everything from seemingly third-world living conditions to high terror alert tension during the recent Olympics to the bullying from the cruel Putin regime, including its strong-arming of the Ukraine. The U.S. corporate media has painted Putin and Russia as public enemy number one, reviving Cold War rhetoric and out-of-date tactics. For example, even before the Sochi Olympics began, the New York Times headlines read, "Terrorism and tension, not sports and joy." Almost unanimously, U.S. reports claim that President Putin also had squandered a record $51 billion on the Olympics, proving his regime to be corrupt. As for the Ukraine crisis, Putin and Russia are depicted as militant bullies, rather than a leader in a country trying to maintain control over strategic oil assets to maintain the country's sphere of influence. Also identified by Cohen, the corporate media's coverage of Putin and the Ukraine is part of a larger pattern of bias. He describes the positive U.S. press coverage enjoyed by President Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s at a time when, quote, the U.S. media adopted Washington's narrative that almost everything President Boris Yeltsin did was a transition from communism to democracy, and thus in America's best interest, end quote. Whereas the U.S. media presented Yeltsin as pursuing legitimate politics and national interests, the frame that the U.S. media now uses to portray Putin and Russia is that it's Putin's Russia, and that it has no legitimate politics and national interests, even on its own borders, as in the Ukraine. Assessing corporate news coverage of the Ukraine crisis, Cohen concludes that, quote, American media on Russia today are less objective, less balanced, more conformist, and scarcely less ideological than when they covered the Soviet Russia during the Cold War, end quote. The topic of Russia and the Ukraine will not be going away anytime soon. However, I do wonder if the real story involving Russia and the Ukraine will ever surface in today's corporate-run media. This has been Alexandria McDowell with Project Censored. This underreported news story was researched by Brian Brennan with Diablo Valley College and evaluated by faculty Mickey Huff, also with Diablo Valley College, as part of Project Censored's Validated Independent News Program. For more Validated Independent News stories, go to projectcensored.org and follow the link for Validated News.
Kids slouch on a couch and vouch for this and that. Dude, you gotta see this music video stat. Then they all roll up to the shopping mall, scoping clothes that happen to be in fashion that fall. The gall appalls me. Why should we all be passive recipients of rules we use to test what we deem as deviant? What we treat with lenience or what we shower praise? How we spend our days, our cultural mores, our norms, our styles. Whether we wear berets, smoking all the while, and how we see the destinies of our societies. What we believe defines us as humanity. These things are key to both you and me. So why don't we all decide what they're gonna be? Turn off the TV. Really? Try writing some poetry, maybe, instead of 7 to 10 every
week. That's the music of Shahid Batar, who is also the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. That song's called We Watch Reality. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I am Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. We are joined today for the hour by political scientist and noted author Dr. Michael Parenti. We are also still joined on the line by Dr. Michelle Chozadovsky from the Center of Global Research. And soon we'll be joined by former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. The focus of today's program, for those of you that are just tuning in, is a new book published by Clarity Press. It's called Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. It's edited by Stephen Lenman. Peter and I, along with Nolan Higdon, also have a chapter in this book. We'll talk a little bit about some of that. Before the break, we were talking about the propaganda system and the demonization that has taken place in the media regarding the situation in Ukraine. And, of course, Ed Herman and David Peterson have a chapter in the book all about that. Michelle Chozadovsky, let's bring you in here for a few more minutes, and then we're going to switch over, and we'll have Michael with us for the rest of the program, and we'll have Cynthia McKinney join us. But, Michelle, I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about this kind of,
well,
of propaganda.
I think it's worth noting that while Vladimir Putin is compared to Adolf Hitler, the U.S. administration has supported the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, which is a self-proclaimed neo-Nazi organization, since the end of World War II. It was actually operating under the Third Reich, and it was called the Nachtingale Brigade, which means in German that means nightingale. So the Nightingale Battalion, and in German it's the Bataillon Ukrainische Gruppe Nachtingale. And then it was renamed by the CIA as the Ukrainian Nightingale Brigade, and they maintained support to this organization right from the end, right from the Truman administration onwards, and it was used as a means of destabilizing the Soviet Union, and it was in a sense an integral part of what was called the Truman Doctrine, which at the time was formulated by State Department official George Kennan. So, you know, the Western media will never acknowledge the fact that the U.S. government has supported neo-Nazi groups for the last more than a half century, but they're very easy in making statements that the head of state of a country which was involved in fighting Nazism during World War II. I'm talking about the Soviet Union. Well, he's head of state of the Russian Federation. Is comparable to Hitler, and in fact we could build upon these the links that the U.S. administration, even the Bush family, have to Nazi elements in the Third Reich. I don't want to get into that, but there's one aspect of propaganda, is that the word Nazi is taboo in the lexicon of Western media. You will not see the use of the word Nazi or neo-Nazi in relation to anything in Ukraine. They will use the term ultra-conservative, freedom fighter, right-wing, nationalist, but they will never use the term, which ultimately they're denying the fact that these people proclaim allegiance to Adolf Hitler and Stepan Bandera. But in the Western media, we don't mention it. And we know, for instance, when John McCain goes to, Ukraine, well, he meets up with Oleg Chernybok, who is the head of Svoboda. It's a neo-Nazi party. Similarly, well, we have meetings between Victoria Nuland and the leader of Svoboda. So that, in fact, The U.S. Officials are buddy buddy with neo-Nazi politicians, and they have the nerve to accuse Putin of being supporter of Adolf Hitler, when in fact they themselves are complicit in the installation of a neo-Nazi government. Now, all of this doesn't mean, of course, then that, you know, that the U.S. government, by supporting neo-Nazi parties in Ukraine, is neo-Nazi. Well, that is an issue for debate. They are the architects of these political formations, but also the Nightingale Battalion, which has been supported covertly by the CIA for more than half a century.
Michelle, thank you so much for joining us on the air, and certainly that's a good point to end with, and we really appreciate your involvement with this. I think Putin was interviewed on French television on Tuesday, and he's out in the West for the celebration of D-Day, actually, and meeting with a number of allies from World War II. And in his interview, he was it was a fairly hostile interview by French television, asking him about the reemergence of the Russian Empire. And he responded quite clearly. He said, well, we don't have troops in any countries, and the U.S. has troops all over the world. So we looked that up. And out of 190 countries in the UN, the U.S. has troops in 150 of them.
Exactly. So, yeah. No, but that I think he made some jokes in relation to Hillary Clinton. That was quite amusing. It was actually, I think the interview was in French, so he said that making those statements is a symptom of weakness. And he said, faible femme, you know, weak woman. And then he said, well, we can forgive Hillary Clinton for making that statement, but it is to make a statement like that is being on the defensive. The irony is that the Russians are very careful diplomats. They won't go around accusing Victoria Nuland of being socializing with neo-Nazis. No, they don't say that. They're very careful. But, I mean, people have researched it. We have the pictures of Victoria Nuland. We have the pictures of John McCain when he went into Syria. He was buddy-buddy with Al-Qaeda photo op. And then they say, oh, no, they dispelled all these things. They said, well, no, just so happened to be there, and so on and so forth. I mean, here we have, first of all, we have proof that the U.S. administration is supporting neo-Nazism in Ukraine. And we also have proof that the U.S. media systematically, at the level of editors and journalists, has excluded even the use of those terms to describe what is happening in Ukraine.
Exactly. That's Professor Michel Chosadovsky. His contribution to this book on the Ukraine is called Crisis in Ukraine: Russia Extends Its Control Over the Black Sea and Strategic Waterways. You can learn more about Michel and his work at globalresearch.ca. Michel, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Delighted to be on the program.
Michael Parenti is still with us, and he'll be coming back, chiming back in a moment. We also, however, are welcoming Cynthia McKinney to the conversation. Cynthia McKinney is former Green Party candidate for president, former congresswoman. And Cynthia McKinney also appears in the new Project Censored film, Ending the Reign of Junk Food News, and once upon a time wrote an introduction for us at Project Censored. So Cynthia McKinney also is a contributor to this book on Ukraine, edited by Stephen Lenman. And Cynthia joins us by phone. Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much, Cynthia, for joining us today. Your chapter, Libya, Syria, Venezuela, Ukraine, another war based on lies, pretexts, and profiteering. Give us a little background on your contribution to this book by Clarity.
Well, it just so happens that I'm writing my dissertation on Hugo Chavez, and so I'm looking at what happens in Venezuela, and it's strikingly similar to what's happening in Ukraine, and also clearly they use the same template for Syria and Libya, except that with Syria and Libya, they actually got to the point of bombing in Libya and using proxy bombers in Syria. But the point is that a country is being destabilized. The people of the United States are financing it. The president and his administration are leading it, and yet when we search for the truth, it's in very, very short supply. So I thought I would write about these similarities and how now what we understand was the case, or understood to be the case in Libya. Well, now people have recanted and said, well, you know, we really didn't mean this and we really didn't mean that. I'm talking about Amnesty International. I'm talking about the gentleman, Sliman Bushagir, who actually made the allegations that the Libyan government had turned its weapons against its own people and that there were thousands who were dead in Tripoli and in Benghazi. Well, you know, he said, well, I really didn't have any evidence for it. And so, you know, we saw what happened in Syria with the allegations of the sarin gas use, only to find out later that, yes, it was possible that the U.S., the U.S. mercenary force that is in Syria had the capability of launching the sarin gas, even though the people of the United States were told, no, they didn't have the capability. Well, I went to Syria as I went to Libya, and I saw the Syrian soldiers and the civilian, there's a civilian squad of people who also have said, well, we're going to defend our neighborhoods. And I saw the sick and the injured and those who were suffering from exposure to the gas. So this was not something that the people were told the truth about, just as the people were not told the truth about what happened in Libya. Now, it's not really in the news a whole lot, but a similar situation is brewing down in Venezuela right now. And unfortunately, we have the documentation from OCPOR, which is the group that created the chaos in Serbia that preceded the bombing, and it gave the NATO the excuse for bombing Serbia and, getting rid of Milosevic. That organization wrote a document on how to destabilize Venezuela. And so the things that we're seeing in Venezuela are going exactly textbook to this OCPOR document, which is exactly the same way that Libya started and that Syria started. So there's a template that's being used against these countries that basically are really defenseless against this kind of destabilization. And I know the civil rights movement and the tactics of the civil rights movement have now been turned on their head in efforts to destabilize countries that were extending democratic institutions and representation and self-rule and independence to their own people. So what looks like a civil rights movement is in actuality a anti-democracy movement, but it's being portrayed in the opposite fashion to the people of the United States and to the people of the world because of the complicity of the press.
Cynthia, hi, this is Peter Phillips calling. Hey, you know, we wanted you on because you used that word template, and that was very much a part of this Flashpoints in Ukraine book. Our chapter, we lay out that template by looking at the history of Venezuela, of Yugoslavia, of El Salvador, Libya, Syria, Ukraine. And there's patterns here now that you're describing. You know, there's a long-term external funding of opposition parties, USAID and National Endowment for Democracy, and nonprofit organizations, NGOs, are all involved in funding opposition. Funds are then raised to organize public events and mass rallies and demonstrations against the targeted government. And then efforts are made to have an incident happen, and sometimes these are, in fact, false flag operations like the sarin gas in Syria you mentioned, but also sniper shootings in Libya, Ukraine, and Venezuela where external sources blamed on the governments there. And then, of course, the international media and the corporate media, they pick up on this. They call for humanitarian interventions and economic sanctions, and then NATO and the U.S. get involved in this. The U.N. may pass resolutions, and there may even be indictments by the criminal court. And finally, as this regime collapses, and the military can actually move in, have no-fly zones in a variety of ways. So these are patterns of behavior, I think, that you're very similar in your chapter that you talked about.
Yes, exactly. And so now what does this mean? It means that we have to call out those so-called human rights organizations that actually are mere mouthpieces for an imperial U.S. policy. And I'm talking specifically about Human Rights Watch. I'm talking about Amnesty International. I had run-ins with those two organizations when I was trying to get to the truth about what happened in Rwanda, for example. And now we hear that these same organizations have backtracked on what they said at the time. Let justification, there was no justification, but, you know, at least in the public discourse of the government for why it was doing what it was doing, and then they backtracked. So these organizations, and then, of course, the huge culprit is the National Endowment for Democracy, which is actually anti-democratic. It's anti-democracy. And I never will forget that I first began to pay attention to the National Endowment for Democracy when I read that it provided some $30 million against the Sandinista government in Nicaragua for Violeta Chamorro. And, of course, you put that kind of money in an election, and, of course, they're going to win. You put that kind of money in an election inside the United States, and whoever supplies that kind of money is going to win. That's what we have seen. So this kind of interference in the domestic affairs of other countries is just outrageous. And I'm surprised that the people of the United States aren't up in arms, because the money that is deployed in anti-democracy should be used for pro-democracy right here at home.
Well, Cynthia, this is Michael Parenti. How are you? It's so good to hear you.
Oh, my goodness.
Goodness has nothing to do with it. They dragged me out of my house to get me. Cynthia, You know, it's more than interference. It's really criminal incursions and such. It's the smashing and the killing of soft targets in the country. It goes back, you can go back even a little further to Nicaragua. After the Nicaraguan people had a hopeful, inspiring, a democratic revolution against a tyrant, and when they took over, you had Ronald Reagan, and as you just mentioned, the National Endowment for Democracy, it wasn't just to rig or to finance elections and buy elections, but it was to blow up daycare centers and clinics and collective farms were destroyed, and that's what's happening in Venezuela today. They're just hitting soft targets, and no government can protect every soft target in its own country, because everything is a soft target. Every store, every school, every house, every hospital. And so you have these murderers, these death squad murderers going at it in Venezuela, very much in a way they were doing in Ukraine, in the way they were doing it in Thailand. Well, I take it back, because Thailand has a right-wing military that did the dirty work there. They didn't need to do those kind of things. But that kind of stuff was happening in Libya, in Syria, and the like. And you have in America our progressive and so-called really liberal and critical people do not deal with these things. I remember... Well, I was writing a letter in the Washington Post, and I said, and I wanted to attack Reagan, and I know the Post would go just so far with that. And I said, Ronald Reagan is obsessed with the Sandinistas. I didn't believe that, I realized after I wrote it. But that got picked up, by the way, in other letters and in columns. Everybody started talking about Reagan's obsession. They reduced it to a psychological condition. But it wasn't a psychological condition. He was doing a very fine, conscious job of destroying the Nicaraguan revolution and destabilizing and immiserating the countries. The people get so battered that they finally give in and they don't pursue a new course at all. They learn that if they want to survive and they don't want to be completely wiped out and killed, this is what they've got to do, and they've got to line up. But to use that word obsession, it's a psychological and easy term, and it fixes only on the individual, a creep named Ronald Reagan. And you reduce that overall global policy to some anomaly perpetrated by this creep, Ronald Reagan. And that's not true at all. That policy is very consistent. That's what I've been trying to say. It repeats itself, whether it's in Thailand or Venezuela or Ukraine or Libya or Syria. Those are the countries where it's going on right now. And Egypt, they got a new Mubarak. Mubarak is in. His name is Sisi now, isn't it? But he's the military guy, and he won an election with a, what, 110% vote or something, 102% or what was it? Exactly. Nobody said a word about, isn't this kind of fishy, or what's this going on here? But everybody's accusing Putin of pulling the strings on the Eastern Ukraine elections, which is totally untrue.
And you know, the United States ought to take care of its own elections. When you have an election and only 16% of the electorate turn up to vote, that's ridiculous. And I'm not even talking about the 16% of the potential voters. That's the voting age population. I'm talking about 16% of those who are actually registered to vote. But if we extended that analysis to those who are of voting age but not yet registered, then it goes down to probably something like 10%.
Cynthia McKinney. Cynthia, I'm afraid we have to cut you off there. We're out of time, unfortunately. We are going to do another program on this book, on Flashpoint in the Ukraine. We certainly, you know, we brought up so many other points here. You know, the top 10 U.S. aid recipients all practice torture. You know, we could do so many other shows on this. It's been a delight to talk to you, Cynthia McKinney. We'll definitely have you back on. Thanks to our guest, Michelle Chozadowski. Also, thank you for sitting in with us for the entire hour, Michael Parenti. It's always a pleasure to see you and hear your insights. all contributors, along with Peter and I and Nolan Higdon, to Flashpoint in Ukraine, how the U.S. driver hegemony risks World War III. Next week on the Project Censored Show, we'll be talking about rad dads and hip mamas in honor of Father's Day and radical parenting. You are tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. A special thanks to Anthony Fest and Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on over a dozen stations around the U.S. Archives can be found at projectcensored.org. Yeah, I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.